Hey, this is Hal Hester. I'm the pastor of Vineyard Christian Church, and this is our podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope this message inspires you, builds your faith, and gives you perspective on how God is moving in your life. Please enjoy the message.
All right, and welcome to another installment of Living an Epic Life, Vincini and his classic blunders from The Princess Bride. I'm sure that most of you have seen it at some point in your life, but always one of my favorite clips from movie history. And, you know, there are some actual validity. There is a little bit of validity to Vincini's list of the classic blunders. That first one, never get in a land war in Asia, was actually a quote from Douglas MacArthur during the Korean War and is an often repeated refrain of fans of the board Risk. If you've ever played Risk, don't ask me how I know, but let me tell you. The second classic blunder, of course, was never go against a Sicilian when death is on the line. Well, the third, let me add to that today, is never try to wipe out God's people. It will always lead to your demise. Listen, as you look through the scriptures, look through the evidence of history, every time that a people or a nation has waged war against Israel or the church, it is lost in the end. In fact, in many cases, almost exclusively throughout the Old Testament, the thing that we see is that those nations who waged war against them were not just defeated, but absolutely wiped from the face of the earth. In this week's edition of Living an Epic Life, we're taking a look at Haman as he is about to find out the truth of that third classic blunder. So let's catch up a little bit here as we've been going throughout this series. The king of the Medes and Persians is King Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes. He's a terrible person, a cruel king. He's one of the most famous and powerful in history. And one of his henchmen is this guy named Haman, who is absolutely a pitiful excuse for a man. He's a sniveling coward and a bully. He's wound up as the king's right-hand man. But he is really distraught over the simple fact that one of the king's guards, a loyal servant, a Jew named Mordecai, who is a deep follower of the Torah, bows to no one except his God and king. He's upset with him because he hasn't bowed down before Haman. So Haman has decided that Mordecai and all the Jews need to die. He decided they all need to die. And so he's been plotting this scheme against them to do just that. Now, in contrast, Mordecai is highly favored by the king for uncovering an assassination plot against him. So the king has had Haman parade Mordecai through the city in a way to honor him. Now, unknown to Haman, Mordecai is the cousin of Queen Esther, his beloved queen. And the king didn't even know it either, as he was listening to all the direction that Haman was given. And so at this moment, we're about to see the point in which Haman's plot is uncovered and which Queen Esther is going to expose him. So let's take a look at Esther chapter 7 this morning. Esther chapter 7. Can I get the lights on this side of the room? All right, let's take a look. Esther chapter 7, beginning in verse 1, and we read, "And so the king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther, and on the second day they were drinking wine after the feast, and the king again said to Esther, 'What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled.' Then Queen Esther answered, 'If I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I wouldn't have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with what the loss of the king.' And then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, 'Who is he? Where is he who has dared to do this?' And Esther replied, 'A foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman.' Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath from drinking the wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And when the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was on the couch where Esther was, falling all over her. He said, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. And then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance of the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on them. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the wrath of the king was abated. Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. Well, I tell you what, in a situation like that, I mean, the first time you read that text, I think our first instance in that moment is to think, well, certainly Haman has deserved this moment. It seems his just desserts have been served to him. We can't help but kind of, in a way, to be glad that Haman has suffered justly the things that he had tried to do to others. But before you quickly judge Haman, let me help you recall what's happened in the last 24 hours in the life of Haman. See, we've been looking at these at this chapter by chapter, week after week, and so weeks have passed since we began this whole conversation on this first point of what Haman has done. And so it seems to us that a great deal of time has passed. But over that period of time, it's actually only been 24 hours for Haman. 24 hours ago, Haman was invited to the queen's house for dinner. 24 hours ago, he was the right hand of the king. He was a man of honor. He was a man being recognized for his place at the king's right hand side there. And yet, the truth is that Haman was not that kind of man. That Haman had wormed his way in and gotten to a place of privilege and honor. But the truth was is that he was a sore excuse for a man, a sorry man. But yet, listen, here's the thing. Mordecai, or Haman, believed that he was a good man. Haman thought he was all of that in a bag of chips. But here's the thing. In the midst of it, you and I saw things laid out for us about the character and the nature of Haman, that even as he's going along and even as he's being honored, the thing is that deep inside he's full of conflict. Deep inside he's full of turmoil. Deep inside he's full of all kinds of insecurity, so that he can't stop pouting. I mean, as he's leaving the queen's house that first night, and he's on his way home, and he sees Mordecai over there, and that Mordecai doesn't bow to him. He doesn't bother to find out why Mordecai doesn't bow to him. He's heard that he's a Jew. He's found out that the Jews do not bow to anyone except their God and their king. But he hasn't asked any questions. He hasn't asked anything. He hasn't explored these things. He hasn't had a discussion with Mordecai. He hasn't challenged him over these things. No, instead, he's wanted to pursue his life simply because of the slight that he's received. He's just an ordinary man. Even though he's excelled and found himself at the right hand of the king, the truth is he's full of all of his own insecurities. And so he goes home pouting and whining and complaining. The next morning, after he's whined and complained and he's had these gallows built, he goes to the king in order to pursue Mordecai's life, to have him destroyed that very day. Instead, when he gets there to ask permission to murder Mordecai, he finds out that he's greeted by the king, whom God has awakened in the night and reminded him of Mordecai's service, so that it prompted the king to tell Haman to go out and to lead him through the city, to give honor to him as one in whom the king wants to honor. And so he finds himself that morning, just 12 hours earlier, leading Mordecai through the streets, praising him. 24 hours ago, he was the king's right-hand man. He was the person being most exonerated by the king, most exalted by the king. 12 hours later, he finds himself giving glory and honor to the person he hates the most, to the person he wants to see undone. 20 hours later, he finds himself back in his own home, complaining to his friends and his family about what's happened, worrying about the events and how they've unfolded. And his family tells him, and I'm not exactly quoting the text, maybe it's more of a paraphrase, dude, God is hot on your trail. This will be your undoing. This is the moment. I mean, if this is what you've wanted and God has unfolded these plans so that now that you are in this situation, God is about to undo you. And now, no sooner have they spoken these words and the king's bodyguards have come to get him and to bring him into the queen's court, to bring him there to meet his final moment of revelation. He doesn't know what's happened. He doesn't know. He's just simply going to that dinner, a moment which should be his greatest honor. I mean, he has been honored by the queen, invited to the special meal. I mean, there's every reason for him to have all kinds of joy in his heart. But here's the thing is that he knows deep down inside his undoing. He knows how he's behaved. He knows his own insecurities and everything else. And so in that moment where everybody else is having a great time, he is not. You ever been in that situation? Ever been in a moment where you were invited to a party and yet deep in your heart and on your mind are things about what should have happened or what didn't happen? Maybe you're worried about things that you did, or maybe you're worried about things that you didn't do. Or maybe it's because of a situation, your health or whatever else, but you find yourself in the middle of a party and everyone around you is having a good time. Everyone else around you is being merry, but deep inside you're disconnected from the events, wondering what's going to unfold, wondering what's going to happen. You know, although God's name is never mentioned in the text, we see how God has been intervening in the events of these people's lives, intervening in the life of Esther, intervening in the life of Mordecai, intervening in the life of Haman. In 24 hours, Haman went from great favor to food for worms because he turned on the Jews. In the middle of that, God will exalt his own people in the courts of the king. He will use Mordecai not only because he's humble and because he does the right thing, but because God wanted to put him in a place where he would be able to use him to advance the cause of the Jews in that nation. God plucks Esther out of obscurity to become queen, not only because she is humble and willing to do things and have integrity and courage, but because God is positioning her to have influence in that kingdom for what is about to happen. But 24 hours earlier, it looked like all that was looked like all was lost. 24 hours earlier, Haman was on top of the world for every purpose, and yet at the same time couldn't get out of the funk of the simple fact that somebody wouldn't bow to him. 24 hours later, the king is drunk and happy, but deep inside Haman knows that he's in trouble. 24 hours later, a king promises to his queen anything she wants, up to half his kingdom. Do you know how many stupid things have been done by a drunken, horny king? Can I just tell you that we see it throughout the scriptures? How many times there's a situation in which the king makes a promise, up to half my kingdom, I'll do all of these things if just because you pleased me. You know, when it's Haman, we cheer. But when it was John the Baptist, we wept. The king is beside himself with rage. How could anybody do this to my queen? See, he spent the last 24 hours in her company and all this time. I mean, he let her go and ignored her for 30 days. I don't know how really loyal or anything else that he was to her. But hey, in this last 24 hours, he's been having this great time with her. He's been enjoying himself and he's excited about what's happening and he's pleased with himself and with her. And yet in a moment, he will absolutely lose his mind over what Haman has done. The king, beside himself with rage, goes outside. And when he comes back in, it's like the comedy of errors, isn't it? I mean, have you ever done something stupid and then in that moment realized that what you did was foolish and you undermined yourself, or that your actions, your behavior has undone you, and you think to yourself, what can I do to make it right? How can I fix the situation? And I mean, really, Haman is in that situation. He suddenly realized how his foolishness has brought him to this point, how his pride has brought him to this point, but it's really too late. He's had multiple times to repent. He's had multiple opportunities to do things different, but he doesn't do it. And so now in this moment, he's begging for his life. But look how it looks when the king walks in. I mean, he is laying there on the couch begging for his life. But what does it look like to the king? The king walks in and it looks like this guy's trying to molest his wife. And in that moment, it's kind of like, here, Esther, hold my beer. Watch this. I mean, he's ready in that moment, you know, a drunken king who's gone from being joyful and couldn't wait to have a good time with his wife, and now suddenly he is enraged. There's nothing that he can do to escape. No reasoning. No way to explain himself. There's nothing that he can say. There's no way he can back down or back out. And the gallows that he had just had built, the paint hasn't even dried yet, and yet he will hang on them that very night. Justice was swift and without mercy. You know, oftentimes we think to ourselves, you know, as we look through things in Scripture, many times we see what appears to be very swift justice. You know, the truth is that most of the time in the Bible that justice is very slow to come about. We miss those little cues, those segues in the chapters where it talks about that there had been 100 years between one event and the next, or a decade or several years or whatever else. Typically, the heart of God is that he's very patient with us in our times of trial and difficulty. When we do stupid and we beg the Lord to work in our lives, and yet he does that. He gives us grace. He gives us mercy. But the truth is what we want God to do is we want him to be swift in his judgment of other people and slow and merciful with us to give us time to repent. You ever done something stupid that took you a long time to figure out just how stupid it was? You ever done something and thought to yourself, man, I am really glad that judgment was not swift within 24 hours. Sometimes it takes us much longer than that to figure out what we've done, or what we haven't done, what we should have done. Sometimes we ask, God, why isn't it all swift without mercy? And other times we're so grateful that it wasn't swift and that it was with great mercy. You know, about 25 years ago, I was faced with some very difficult circumstances. A family member had falsely accused me of doing some things. There was no evidence, but they continued to persist and eventually were dragging me into court, accusing me of these things. And although I won repeatedly, it was very costly. At the time, we were living up in Central Canada, and, you know, gasoline was like $5 a gallon, when it was $1 a gallon here. And so even just getting out of Canada to drive all the way down to the southern part of the United States and to fight those battles was getting very expensive. And every time I won, I thought that would be the end of it. But somehow they would find some little loophole in which they would continue to aggravate the case, make new accusations, or retry the thing, or find a problem with it, or whatever else. And it just kept going on and on and on for a period of about 5 years. Finally, at the end of that, some friends and family began to fast and pray. And we really felt like the Lord had given me the answer that we needed. We felt like, you know, deliverance was at hand. And in fact, there was several people who gave me a word and said, the Lord has got this. And so I was like, oh, that's great. The Lord's got this. You know, I can just relax and go into this with confidence. And so I did. I relaxed and I went in with confidence. And almost on every point, they won. I was so devastated. I was angry with God. I couldn't figure out how this could happen. And I remember being that night, I was so angry with God that even when we sat down to dinner, I didn't even want to pray because I was of my anger at God. How that I felt like he had deceived me, that he had not met my needs, that he had not been there for me, that he left me to my enemy. I knew it was going to take a very long time to recover. I was so angry with God. How could this be? It did take me a long time to recover. Thankfully, in the midst of it, some great Christians around me reminded me of God's perspective and how that it was different than mine. In the midst of it, they were telling me to hold on and to believe God, that the events were not over, that I might still see the hand of God's deliverance, but that I needed to trust God, believe God, to believe that He was good. Fast forward, 10 years later, God restored everything to me. Even my enemy's family members that had bankrolled the legal case against me apologized to me. The person who had come against me was proven to be a liar. They lost more than they ever took. Can I tell you that looking back on that situation, I actually feel terrible for them. It's awful how things unfolded. See, 15 years have given me a much different perspective today than I had in the moment when I wanted all hell to break loose in their life, when I wanted the wrath of God to fall upon them. See, I wanted nothing more than swift and sure destruction on their part. But over the years, I've begun to see this whole thing of God's mercy and God's perspective, recognizing the insecurity of others and how many times I myself have done what was wrong, acted unkindly, did things to hurt people. And I'm so grateful that God was merciful to me, was slow to anger. See, I was angry at God for my hardship. Angry at God for not fixing everything before it ever began. I could not see things from God's perspective. Take a look there at verse 4 in chapter 7. And listen to Esther's words. If we had merely been sold as slaves. Can you let that sink in for just a moment? I say, like you, I'm a 21st century Western Christian. To me, the thought of slavery as a free person, I mean, I can't imagine anything more terrible, anything more horrifying than to be sold as a slave. And then I read Esther's words. If we had just been sold as slaves. Her statement is incomprehensible to me. What do you mean, just? You see, the thing is it's amazing how our lives, our perspective, are colored by our situations, by understanding, by things that we think about in our lives, by the values we hold. Oftentimes, you and I, we believe that God should have the same response to every offense, every hardship, every slap in the face, every indignity that we have. We expect God to react in the moment like we react in the moment, to feel like we feel. Oftentimes those feelings are conditioned by our perspective. When Esther says, just slavery, I think, slavery? Are you kidding me? I don't share her perspective. I don't know what it was like to live in her world. Moreover, I don't have God's perspective always either. And I'm not saying that Esther does in that situation. Please don't think that God blows off slavery or that Esther is justifying slavery. I just simply mean that there is this sense of in which perspective is askew by the events and the people and the events of their time, the day and time in which they live in. And God, who knows the beginning from the end, who knows the circumstances we don't, can work even in the most difficult of circumstances. Consider the plight of Esther. I mean, when you and I look at it, we see her heroics and the things that she gained. We see the fact that she was queen, and we think, well, what could be awful about being a queen? But we forget who she's married to. Xerxes, one of the most vile and perverse men ever recorded about in history. When you read about the kind of orgies and things that he threw, you understand the way he treated women and the way he treated people, the kind of ways that he had people murdered simply because they disagreed with him and stuff, you begin to realize what a vile, evil man this is that she's married to. And yet God is using her in some incredible ways. God uses her to preserve the Jews, to preserve his plan to rescue God's people. He uses her in a place of influence later on so that her stepson, Artaxerxes, will be the one who will make sure that the temple of God is rebuilt. He'll use the resources of the Medes and the Persians to reestablish the city of Jerusalem and to rebuild its walls. He'll take a young man from their court who served under Mordecai and will send him back under Artaxerxes to make sure that things are built and things are taken care of, to make sure that the king's treasury is spent well. We really don't know exactly what God is doing, but we do know this. When we step back and we have the biblical perspective for that moment, that you and I can see how God is working in those segues, in those moments where he's working in the lives and the hearts of people, where he's even working in some of the most horrific of circumstances to bring about good things, to bring about hope, to bring about deliverance, to rescue people in their circumstances. See, I'm not saying that Esther's plight didn't matter. I'm saying that God's perspective on our earthly life and our difficulties is not nearly as reactionary as ours. He moves decisively when his plans are at stake. But in the grand narrative of life and history, God moves with intentionality and purpose that exceeds our understanding. I mean, when I think about it, and I think about the events that happened in the garden, in the fall, why was it that whenever he made that promise to them that there would be a child born of a woman, not of man, who would be the deliverer, why didn't Jesus come right then? Why was it that God would use these circumstances and use a kingdom and use kings? Why would he use prophets and all and spend all of that time sowing these things throughout history and explaining himself and demonstrating his faithfulness, his goodness, his kindness? Why didn't he do it the way I thought he should do it? Why didn't God do it in my timing? Why didn't God do it in our timing? Why am I in this situation now? Why are you in the situation that you are in now? God moves with intentionality and with purpose that exceeds our understanding or our perspective. And it's in moments like that that you and I have to trust God. See, it was in that moment 25 years ago whenever I was watching those things unfold and I thought, God, you need to do this in this moment. You need to rescue me. You need to deliver me because what they're doing to me is unfair, unkind, it's harsh, it's unjust. And when God said, 10 years later, I've got this. Or 5 years later that I've got this. When 10 years later, I began to see it unfold and work together. Can I tell you that all the things that I thought should happen to them happened and more? The difference was in that moment, I couldn't wait for it to happen. I wanted them to suffer the way that they were causing me to suffer. My perspective 25 years later I cannot help but feel sorry for them. God resolved my dilemma not when I wanted, but he solved it. Looking back at all that has befallen my enemy, what happened to them, I don't rejoice in it. Instead, I see a person created in the image of God that failed to repent, failed to do the right thing, who was given multiple opportunities to turn things around. Likewise, I see myself in moments where I've been stubborn and needed God's delayed judgment and mercy and grateful that I found it. And just like Esther, You see, I realized that there were worse things that could befall me. I realized that things could have turned out very differently. I realized that how God was working, even in the midst of my hardship, my difficulty, my circumstances that I didn't like, when they unfolded in a way that I wouldn't have had them unfold if it was up to me. You see, I've watched how God has worked in my heart and in my life to make me who I am today, to work in the circumstances and the lives of other people, what he did in other people's lives in that whole process. How he changed hearts over a long period of time. And why it was necessary for me to trust God and believe him. On that day, when things did not turn out the way that I thought they should have, that God really did have it. God really was planning on taking care of it. It just wasn't exactly in the timing that I thought it should have happened. It wasn't in the way I thought it should happen, and so I lost perspective. See, it was not my plan. And sometimes along the way, you know, here's the thing I've discovered. Have you figured this part out? That just because it's your plan doesn't mean it's God's plan. Have you found out that along the way that oftentimes God is doing things in the midst of what looks like the most difficult and terrible of circumstances to bring about his ultimate plan, his ultimate good, his ultimate glory? And while I think to myself, 25 years is a long time, about our 70 years on the earth, the Bible describes it as but a vapor, something that passes like that. You see, oftentimes we live in this kind of present perspective where all we can see is what's immediately happening right now. And we feel like we have to grab everything, to have everything, to do everything in this moment with no real awareness that an eternal God is using this moment to shape us, to form us for his eternal plan. And so I have to remind myself sometimes, my plan might be just my plan. It may not be God's plan. It may not be God's way of working these things out. But what I do know is this, is that a good God who loves me and loves his people and ultimately wants to see his plan unfold in our lives because it is what is best and what is just, that he is unfolding those plans, those circumstances in my life, maybe not exactly in the way that I want them to be. Maybe not exactly in the way that I would choose those things, but to believe that a good and just God will ultimately see justice served, will redeem all the things that he is using in my life, even my pain, even my hardships, even my difficulty. And in those moments when justice is swift and sure, that rather than it rejoicing my heart to stop and to remember the person in need of redemption, the person in need of God's mercy that was behind that plan, and to join with the saints of old and to cry out for mercy for every generation, for every people group under heaven. Yes, even to love my enemies. It may not be my plan, but it is his plan. Let's stand together, shall we? So Vanzini speaks of classical blunders, land wars in Asia, Sicilians in death. We speak of classical blunders like trying to wipe out God's people. But you know, for most of us, we will never be put in that kind of position. Those are world leader kind of blunders. For most of us, the classic blunders are things that more directly affect our lives. They're things that we are certain of, but are actually foolish. The classical blunder to believe that we don't need the church. You know, in my most painful moments, it was my relationships in the church that provided perspective and helped me to trust God when I could not. They were the voices that spoke to me, and my circumstances and the surroundings, the things that were happening to me and around me, and they reminded me to trust God in those moments. See, it's easy sometimes to think, well, I'm saved and I don't need the people of God. I don't need His church. I don't need anyone else around me. I've got this. I've got it, and everything's fine. And the way I see things, I mean, I'm saved. What more could there be? And yet in reality, there's this, that in the midst of my circumstances and my trials and my difficulties, that it's there where the people of God speak into my life and uphold me. It's there in the midst of those difficulties and trials and circumstances where people uphold me and give me God's perspective on my events and my situation. It's there in the midst of those most painful moments where God speaks through other people and helps me to stand in the midst of my trials, my hardships, my difficulties. And you know, not only do I need God to do that in my life, but you need God to do it in your life. You need people to speak into your life. You need people to be a blessing in your life. And people need you to speak into their lives and to be a blessing in their lives. That we don't just gather together because to take tithes and offerings. We don't just gather together to sing songs of praise or to be entertained by messages or videos or anything else. But in truth, the classical blunder is to believe that we can do this life on our own, when in truth, it's God who calls us to be the church, the body of Christ, and to walk with one another in good times and bad.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast today. And if you did, there's two things I'd love to ask of you. Number one, would you subscribe to our show? That way, the most recent podcast will be in your feed, ready for you when you are. And secondly, if this ministry has impacted you and you'd like to help us continue to reach others, you can click on the link in the description to give now.